Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Randy Krutz, the Chief Executive Officer of U.S. Farmers and Ranchers. I'd certainly like to welcome you all. We're working very quickly to cool the room down, although I do see a stocking cap out there, so it's maybe not too bad. But so we do want to make you all comfortable, and we're pretty crowded. But other than that, it's a great room, and we're very excited to have you all here today. For those of you who are not familiar with U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, we are a group of more than 80 farmer and rancher organizations and agricultural partners representing virtually all aspects of agriculture. We work to engage in dialogue with consumers who have questions about how their food is raised and produced. Welcome to today's discussion entitled The Next Generation of American Farmers and Ranchers. Last month, when we were here in Washington at the USDA's Ag Outlook Forum, the new census was released. In that report, the average age of American farmers is now just north of 58 years of age. And, of course, that varies across the country into the 60s and down to 55. As an industry, we need to continue to look for ways to bring younger people into farming since they are the future of farming and ranching in our country. The next generation are taking over and modernizing their family operations, even during highly challenging times when the industry is dealing with some of the most hotly debated issues in our history. Tomorrow evening, we will continue the theme that we have going here today when we take a close look at the dynamic, that those dynamics through a private screening and industry debut of the documentary called Farmland, which I'm sure by now most of you have heard of. This feature-length film is about the next generation of farmers and ranchers, has been produced in cooperation with James Mole, an Oscar-winning and two-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. The film takes us into the lives of six young farmers and ranchers and gives us an up-close and personal look at some of the latest farming procedures, practices, and technologies that are changing and improving the landscape of modern agriculture. Today, we're going to share our trailer with you. I'm sure it will create some discussion, and many of you, again, have likely seen it, but we want to share it, and let me introduce Farmland.
When people see farmers, they think GMOs.
Genetically modified organisms.
The term organic, certified organic.
Well, natural.
I don't like to see anything that's treated.
Treating an animal humanely.
It's just a corporation.
We're a family farm.
Clean food.
The drought. Will we run out of it?
Public perception.
Stereotype.
Most people don't understand the farm.
What does the public want to know? What do they need to know?
We're not hiding anything, but what do you want to know?
There is a misunderstanding of where our food comes from.
You can't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a rancher. It doesn't work that way.
The number of people coming back to the family farm has decreased substantially.
There's a lot more challenges into starting farming than there used to be.
When I started, no one believed in me. Nobody.
It's definitely tough being in this developmental stage of my business.
You better water them right now.
My dad started this farm.
Now this is pretty tall.
This is the legacy we are carrying on.
Why does this not seem fair?
As a 26-year-old, I am, to my knowledge, the youngest rancher in Throckmorton County.
We need to have young people go into farming. Who's going to grow our food?
So I hope you enjoyed the preview. Is Brad Bella in the room today? Is he here? Brad is in the room. Brad and Layton are in the film. If you don't recognize Layton's voice yet, you will in a minute. So if you have questions about tomorrow's screening, please find one of the staff that are floating around today or myself and ask about it, and we can give you information. We are filling up quickly. We're very excited about the attendance, and it's at the Reagan International Theater. And so find us, and we'll talk to you about it. On a day when we celebrate agriculture, USFRA has brought together this panel of individuals to tell real stories about modern agriculture. We hope today's discussion will motivate others to confidently tell their own stories and inspire a whole new generation of farmers and ranchers across the country. If you're sharing today's discussion on Facebook or Twitter, and we encourage you to do so, please use the hashtag FOODD, so F-O-O-D-D. We welcome your questions during today's panel. You can participate in two ways. First, we have the microphones on either side of the room. Please line up and we'll take your questions and get your answers as quickly as we can. And you should have found cards on your seats when you sat down, and you can fill those out, hold them up, and we'll collect them, and we'll get your questions answered then as well. So thank you for this. Here to moderate is Sarah Wyant. Sarah is is president of AgriPulse Communications. She's an award-winning storyteller and family farmer, an advocate of agriculture, and just a great person. Thank you, Sarah, for being here today, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you very much to all of you for joining us this afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here as your moderator. And I especially want to thank USFRA for hosting this event, the dialogue, and our panel discussion on the next generation of America's farmers and ranchers. As Randy mentioned, I know our team is going to be tweeting from here at AgriPulse, but if you're tweeting about this event, please include the hashtag food and then a capital D for food dialogues. And he also reinforced the fact that we'd like to hear from you, your questions for this distinguished panel, either by submitting your questions online, and so I'll be able to pick them up here on my iPad, or by coming to one of the microphones in front. So we welcome your participation as well. So to get us started this morning, I'd like to make some brief introductions. On my far right is Peter Leibold, who's a curator of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. Now, Peter's currently very, very busy working on the Agricultural Innovation and Heritage Archive, trying to preserve all the recent history of U.S. farming and ranching and building this comprehensive digital archive. So we welcome Peter to our group. Next to Peter is Kate Danner, a fifth-generation family farmer with a 1,500-acre row crop from western Illinois. She's also an ambassador for the Illinois Soybean Association. To my immediate right is Leighton Cooley. As Randy mentioned, you're going to see a lot more of Leighton, a star of the Farmland documentary. He's a fourth-generation poultry farmer from Roberta, Georgia. On my left is Will Gilmer, a third-generation dairy farmer from Lamar County, Alabama, and representing the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, and also has quite a following for some of his YouTube videos. On his left is Seth Pratt, a fifth-generation cattle and livestock rancher from Blackfoot, Idaho. And Seth is currently in college at the University of Idaho. He'll tell you a little bit more about that later. But he's a former national FFA officer and also recognized as an FFA New Century Farmer. So pleased to have him. And last but certainly not least, on the far left here is Joel Mathewitz, who I first met at an AFA meeting several years ago. He's currently a corn, soybean, pea, and lamb farmer from Minnesota, and also serving as executive director of the Minnesota Ag in the Classroom Foundation. So welcome to all of our panelists here today. And I'd like to kick off by having a short presentation from Peter to tell us a little bit more about your work with the Smithsonian. Peter?
Thanks a lot, Sarah. It's really my pleasure to be here today, and you all might wonder why the heck in presentation about the future, about today and about the future, we should be looking at the past. And I think it's actually really critical. First of all, we should always respect the past, what people have contributed. But it's the most important thing to remember is that agriculture is really important. It is what started our country and it continues to be critical. So we've got a fabulous panel of the future, where agriculture is going. And I want to give you a really speedy run through the history of ag that will really set the stage for them. I work at the National Museum of American History. It's on the National Mall. You can't actually do any shopping on this mall. It's that stretch of ground between the Washington Monument and the Capitol Building. And we're working on a big new exhibition called American Enterprise. This is a major undertaking for us, really telling the story of the nation, of the people, through stories in business. And what's really interesting is that we're including agriculture in this. Instead of having an ag hall off by itself, we're integrating the story of agriculture in with everything else. So we're looking at five big economic sectors, manufacturing, retail and service, IT and communication, farming, agriculture, and finance. And you'll see that all of those sectors really are involved, that finance is a big part of agriculture today. IT is a huge part of it. Agriculture, of course, is the sector itself. So it really makes sense in how they spin together. So what I'd like to do is walk through the exhibition itself very, very briefly. It's divided into four different periods. And so it's chronological in orientation. And in this first period, we call the merchant period, which is 1770s to the 1850s. And, of course, in this time, almost everybody in the United States was farming, probably upwards of 90% of Americans in the time of Jefferson were involved in agriculture. But there are a lot of misconceptions about what those people did, that it wasn't subsistence farming. In fact, that even in the early days, there was a market economy, and export was really important. One of the objects that you see right here is a medallion from when Henry Clay ran for presidency in 1844. And you can see that what it says around it is, the champion of the protective tariff. And what they show is a freighter of the time period, a big sailing ship. And, of course, what it would be loaded on it is you can see the plow and the wheat. So the agricultural exports, even in the beginning of the country, is something that people argued about extensively and really, really thought about. Our next period is the corporate period. This is the time where manufacturing really begins to take off. People start moving from rural areas into cities. And, in fact, by 1920, half of Americans are living in cities. Now, that means that half of Americans are not living in cities, which means that they're probably farming. So even by the end of this period that we associate with big factories, at least half of the country is still involved in agriculture. But what's really key is that this is a point of major change. To think of agriculture as always the same, as steady as it goes, is really wrong. And we have to understand the history of ag is one that has always changed. That farming and ranching, there's never been a perfect period, but it's a field that continues to evolve over time. And I think that, as Shakespeare said, what's past is prologue, that it will continue to change in the future. And this period is really fascinating in that probably the single biggest moment happens, where American agriculture moves from extensive to intensive, where people move from just, if they wanted more food, they'd plow up more land, to starting to become more efficient, more productive. So the height of number of acres under till is someplace in the early 30s, late 20s. And from there, the number of farms actually goes down. However, productivity continues to go up. So the old-fashioned notion of fairly unsophisticated farming, of farming without a lot of real knowledge, starts to move away to farmers that are trained, that really understand farming, and starting to use efficiency as their model. Moving into the next period, the 1940s to the 1970s, much shorter period of time, we're calling the consumer era, and this is where abundance is really the watchword. And we're actually using a giant refrigerator as an artifact to unpack where that food actually comes from. And if you start to look at the graph of efficiency, that farming really starts to become much more effective, fewer people and more materials. And that takes us into the global era, the 1980s to present. And this is, frankly, what I think is the most exciting period of all. This is where our panelists know and live, but most Americans don't understand. And today, agriculture is highly sophisticated. That as a corn farmer friend of mine out in Iowa said, there are no dumb farmers. The only farmers that are not smart are unemployed farmers. That you really have to process a lot of information. You have to do things right. It's a little bit like the Olympics. Did any of you catch some of those Olympic sports? The downhill, I think, is probably the most appropriate. They ski really fast. And farming is a very similar kind of profession. That they are that as efficiency goes up, they're moving at a higher and higher clip. Fewer and fewer people doing things, and if they make a mistake, it can be disastrous. I really think of today's farmers like downhill skiers with their helmets on, just doing superhuman kind of work. And it's really exciting to see how they wrestle with new ideas. GPS has come in, really revolutionized things. Hybridization, which started off in the 20s and 30s, is now really continuing to take off. Biotechnology is really taking it another step further. A lot of things that folks think on the outside may be easy to look at turn out to be very difficult. The notion of spraying herbicides can actually be environmentally the right thing to do. That no-till farming, which is had some of the really biggest environmental successes for the country, is really a result of herbicide application. So it becomes really, really complicated, very interesting period. So that's a quick snapshot of how agriculture has developed. The one other thing I wanted to mention is the farming challenge, which is a little interactive that we will be developing in our exhibition. And this is a really important piece. This moves away from just the history of artifacts, the things like we have the first plow ever used that the John Deere Company made, or Barbara McClintock's microscope. But in the farming challenge, we're letting our visitors come in and have a chance to see farming from a different perspective. It's really like a CEO's office, that going into a faux tractor cab, and they have to make decisions. And I think that's the really important thing to understand, that the farmers of today are consuming vast quantities of information. It's drinking from the proverbial fire hose. And like any CEO of a major business, they have to make decisions about what to do. And if they make the right decisions, they're successful. And they make the wrong decisions, it can put them out of business. And so trying to let our visitors understand that being a farmer and a rancher is more than just driving a tractor, but listening to a lot of information, making a lot of decisions, all of that factors into it. And we'll really give a great opportunity for the people coming to Washington to get a sense of the complexity of what modern agriculture is today. So I invite you all to come back in 2015. July 4 would be the opening, and see it for yourself. Sarah, I'd like to turn it back to you now.
Oh, thank you, Peter. I know you're putting a lot of work into that, and I can't wait to see it for the opening next year. So thank you for all you're doing on behalf of agriculture. For each of our panelists here, we'd like them to kick off before we have our formal Q&A by asking them to share a little bit about their own personal experience coming back to the farm. So Kate, would you lead us off? Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon. My name is Kate Danner. I'm a fifth-generation farmer. I grew up on a farm, but I never really wanted to farm. It was never really a big interest. I grew up on the farm, and I knew that there was a big process between what we grew in the field or what my family grew in the field to the table. My mother's a dietitian, and my father's a farmer, so I really had a large perspective of production to consumption, and science was always the mediator in the middle. I went to college on a volleyball scholarship. I played volleyball, and coincidentally, it was an agricultural school. And so kind of through that, I was really interested. And so I asked Dad all these questions, and finally, towards the end of my associate's degree, I asked my dad, I said, hey, can I come home and farm? And he said, yeah, that's fine. So I came home, and I got a real life perspective of what it's like to farm. And because it's not about can you farm, it's about can you work with your family. And so for some of you to really think about that, it's very different. But after that year of farming with him, I loved working with him. I loved farming. I loved what I did. I loved what I learned. And so I was like, hey, I want to take over the farm. Can I farm with you? And he goes, if you want a career on this farm, you need for your bachelor's degree. I said, okay. So I went to Iowa State University. I triple majored. And the only reason I did was because I was so excited to learn. I took all these classes, and it just kind of wound up to be a triple major because I wanted to be the best farmer that there was. And so now I do all the planting in the spring. I do the scouting in the summer. And in the fall, I do all the trucking. I have my commercial driver's license, so I drive those big semis. And in the fall or in the winter, I do all the planting to prep for the winter. And I am the fifth generation, and each generation has made a deliberate choice to take over the farm. And I'm very proud to carry on the legacy of farming with my family.
Thank you, Kate. Layton?
I am Layton Cooley. I was born and raised on a chicken farm in Middle Georgia. We now raise chickens, cattle, and hay. Love doing it. Work together with my dad all day, every day. We're actually in a partnership with actually me, my dad, mom, and wife. And my wife, Brenda, and I get to raise our two sons, Lawson and Lane, who are 3.5 and 2. We get to raise them on our farm. And, you know, that's something that I can't put a price on. The experiences that they have that I grew up having are so similar, and I enjoy it so much. As far as coming back to the farm, when I left high school and went to college, I actually went on a football scholarship. But I was at a non-ag school. I always wanted an ag degree, but I had the opportunity to go play football. So I went to that school and majored in business education. When I left, there really wasn't much of an opportunity to come back and farm. And I wasn't planning on coming back and farming full time. But the more I was gone, come back home, work on the summers, work on the weekends. But the more I was gone, the more I wanted to be back home on the farm. And I guess for me, getting back into agriculture was desire to be back met with opportunity to come back. And that happened for me. I taught. I was in the education system for a year. But as soon as I came back from college, I actually started in the poultry industry, raising birds, and was able to come back to my family farm. I'm fourth generation poultry farmer, but second generation on our farm. And, for me personally, wanting to come back, but then having the opportunity to come back and join my parents' farm, and I guess, every farm dad's dream is probably for, to have one of their kids come back and farm anyway. And for me, I had that opportunity. My dad and mom made that happen. And I hadn't looked back since. Certainly hadn't regretted it. And I wake up getting to go to work doing what I love doing every day.
Terrific. Will, should I
tell you? My name is Will Gilmer, and as was mentioned, I'm a dairy farmer from Lamar County, Alabama, in the western part of the state. I'm in partnership with my father on the farm. I'm the third generation on the dairy, fourth on our farm, and within our community, my family has been farming now for 6 generations. And my story is somewhat similar to both of our previous panelists. I grew up on the farm, obviously. I worked on the farm through high school, loved working on the farm, but I didn't see an opportunity for me on our family's farm. At the time, my father was in partnership with an uncle, and as far as the size of our farm, we didn't have much opportunity for expansion. So I could see the writing on the wall that if I wanted to come back, I would essentially just be a family employee for however many years until somebody retired and would open a spot up for me. So when I went off to Mississippi State University, I enrolled as a computer engineer. And within 6 weeks of my first computer class, I started looking at the fluorescent lights overhead and the people around, and I just decided this is probably not what I want to spend the next 40 years doing. So I changed my major over to agriculture, and over the course of time while I was in school, my uncle exited the dairy business, which opened up the opportunity for me to come home once I finished college if I wanted to. And I never felt obligated or pushed to do so, but after being away for 4 years at college, I knew for sure that's what I wanted to come back and do. So my father let me work for him for about 4 years, worked me hard, wanted to make sure that's what I wanted to do. And we formed a partnership 10 years ago. I've been partnership ever since. And like Layton mentioned, one of the best parts of being on the farm is having the opportunity to give my kids the same opportunity I had growing up on the farm, experiencing everything that it has to offer and learning the lessons that it offers. And just even from a selfish standpoint, I feel like I'm living every little boy's dream. I play with cows and drive tractors every day. And that's really hard to beat. And I see going forward in the future, I kind of want to do, take the same approach that my father and mother did with me. I never want my children to feel obligated that they need to come back and assume a role on our family farm. I want them to choose their own path. But I want to make sure that over the next several years, as they grow up, I want to do my best to position our farm to a place where should one or both of them want to return home and someday work and eventually take over our family farm, I want to make sure I've done my part to give them that option.
Thank you. Now I know why you're so happy when you're singing.
Sir? Thank you, Sarah. The decision to come home for me, I mean, being the age I am, is a pretty present consideration. It seems that it comes up into my mind just about every day. As was said earlier, I am Generation 5 there in Idaho. My great-great-grandfather homesteaded in 1904. So when you begin to consider stepping into a career like that, it's not like it's a new venture. You know, there's memory, there's sentimentalism, there's tradition. All those things weigh in on how your family operates on that land. And the decisions that you make need to consider that. And, Will, you're exactly right on when you say, I don't want my children to feel pressured to come back. And I hear my forefathers say that, and I think, yeah, sure. sure. We put the pressure on ourselves, whether it's intended or not, we do. And as I sat to think more about that, well, I should say sit, it's about every day, I consider what quality of life you have. And there are times in production agriculture where it's a full-time job. Last week was spring break at the university. I went home and we're calving cows. We're in the middle of calving season, about 25 calves a day right now. So it's a full-time job. It's so full-time that my dad called me on the phone 2 weeks before spring break. He said, I need to know when you're getting here and when you have to leave. I'm going to schedule a meeting with the accountant, my dentist appointment, my eye appointment. He had to do all those there when we were there to cover for him. So there are times of the year it's real busy, but I think back to my childhood and when things happened, birthdays or sporting events or engagements in 4-H, FFA, because my father and my grandfather were their own boss, maybe they pull a double shift the day before, but they were there. And I really value that. Maybe it is more hours per week, but if it means I'm a better husband and a better father, then that's where I'm going to be. So that's the reason that I am making this decision.
Thank you. Joel?
Good afternoon. I'm Joel Mathewitz, and I'm also a fifth-generation farmer out of Morgan, Minnesota. My family tradition, I work with my father, two uncles, and an older brother that are all farming. So when my wife and I joined the family farm, we're supporting five families, not just one. And so the transition of that has taken a different journey. I was real involved in youth organizations of 4-H, FFA, Agriculture Future of America, and it was those peer groups that got me excited about agriculture that I knew I had to be in this industry. And so along that path, I got involved in youth development, got involved in lending, got involved with risk management, had that career off the farm. A few years ago, I broke away from that to start a consulting company, and now back full-time on the farm with my family as my dad and my uncle are starting to phase out a little bit. Also worked with some area farmers in risk management in our crop insurance industry, and then most recently took on a role with Minnesota Ag in the Classroom. I think it's our job as farmers and producers to share our story. And Ag in the Classroom is one of those tools that we use to share our story in classrooms across the great state of Minnesota and across the nation. So I took that as an opportunity to give back and to share the great story that we all have in agriculture.
Well, thank you, and thanks to all of you for your opening comments. We're going to open up for questions now. As I mentioned, the microphones are available, but we're already getting questions in online, and these kind of piggyback with what I wanted to start with anyway. Delaney Gray asks, and Seth on Facebook, they want to know what else can we do to get more people like you into agriculture and back on the farm? And secondarily, you've all got farm backgrounds, so what about suburban kids? Or what about people who don't have that legacy involvement in agriculture that you've had? So here are some thoughts on how we can bring more people into farming and ranching. Layton, I'd like to start with you.
Okay. Certainly, you know, what we all relate to is our own experience, you know, and like you said, you're kind of looking outside of that. As far as, you know, suburban kids or urban kids, I've seen a lot of, maybe not a lot, but it seems like you see kids that grow up on the farm, and they're looking to get off the farm. And then you see kids who had grandparents that farmed. Their parents left the farm back in, you know, 70s, 80s, some of that. I see kids, or I'm not a kid anymore, but I see young people my age or when I was in my early 20s making the same decision. that their families had been off the farm for a generation or two. They were trying to find their way back, you know. And I don't know, there's a lot of challenges to that. You know, probably one of the greatest challenges to starting farming is land availability. I know we've all, you know, considered that and ran into it before. Land is probably the most expensive, I would say, or the most costly capital expenditure to get started farming, especially on the crop end.
Yep.
You know, with me personally in my area, chicken houses were probably the easiest thing at the time. Doesn't take a whole lot of land, takes more capital than you probably plan on in the early 20s. But, you know, I would say that land availability is one of the huge things for people who don't come from, they don't have a farm to go back to. They have to start from scratch, you know, and there's ways to do it, starting renting, you know, stuff like that. You can start through some of the cheaper, but as far as programs, you know, the farm credit systems, they've done, I think, a great job of trying to reach out to young farmers, young and beginnings, to create opportunities to, you know, offer financing for some of the land and things like that. But, you know, taking it farther, you know, I'm not sure.
Did you use any USDA programs? Did any of you use Beginning Farmer and Rancher to get started?
Yeah, I applied for Young Beginner Farmer loan about 3 years ago and was accepted in that program. So it is a great program. It lowers my interest rate, allows me to extend my time frame and give me all 40 years to be able to pay that back, and I'm excited to do so. I think, you know, when we talk about the next generation, I know for me personally, if I wouldn't have been involved in youth organizations and be around peers that had some of the same interests, I would have been strayed a different direction because you want to be accepted and fit in. So I found organizations of 4-H, FFA, and the Agriculture Future of America organization as key in my development. And I look at students today, that's kind of the same thing. And when farmers are less than 2% of the population today, they're looking for that peer group. So for me, how do we get youth engaged earlier? I have two nephews that love to be out with us every day, making the decisions that we are making each and every day. And so I want to get them involved and having that experiential learning that they had as well. So I can remember in eighth grade, my dad gave me 2.9 acres to operate as a 4-H and FFA project. And ever since then, it's changed my livelihood as far as my risk tolerance and my ability to give back and produce food.
Other ideas? Kate, what about bringing more women into agriculture?
Well, I think that women are starting to be more of a face into agriculture now. I mean, if you kind of look back in the history about 100 years ago, I mean, women just got, you know, really the right to vote. And, you know, in the 60s, we couldn't wear pants. And then my mother, actually, she didn't mean to show her age ratings, but when she was in college, there was curfew. So I was like, curfew? What, was high school? You know, but there was actually curfews in college. And you know, I just talked to the director of student services at Iowa State University, and he said that there's actually more women enrolled in the College of Ag now than there are men. And I think that women have always been on the farm. I think we've always had a very important role on the farm. I just think you're going to see more women like myself at the forefront of it.
Other suggestions on how we can bring more people into farming and ranching?
Let me share a little bit about the experience of a student. So College of Agriculture enrollments across the state are all up. Now, different extents based on where we're looking, but across the board, increases. A lot of those increases are from folks that are asking a different question. So for those of us here on the panel, it's, I'd like to go back to the farm. For a lot of these new students, it's, I'd like to become a farmer. And that's fundamentally different. It changes what these students need, and especially educational experiences. One thing I've seen just starting that has offered a lot of value is farmers, ranchers, folks that have opportunities on the land to host students. Maybe you host them just for spring break. Perhaps it's all of the summer months. These students need on-the-ground experience. You know, we may train specialists to diagnose such and such crop diseases or work with animals, but they also need to know how to change the tire on their pickup when it goes flat. Some of those things, it doesn't make sense to teach in a college classroom, so we need experiential learning for those students. I think that's a key thing for these new, if we can call them new, folks that want to come to agriculture rather than return to agriculture. The last point, I'm sure there's 100 that could be made, but the last point I'd like to make is agriculture used to be geographically dispersed, and that was a big deal. Now, I left Idaho yesterday, and I'm here on the other side of the country today. That's an incredible and pretty new ability. Because of that, we used to have Extension Service, the Grange, the Farm Bureau. Their job was disseminating knowledge to all those farmers. It wasn't easy to get it instantly. We didn't have iPads like what you have, Ms. Sarah. Geography used to be a big thing. It's becoming less, but this network still exists, this network of extension of the Farm Bureau, of the producer groups. That network is incredibly valuable today for bringing and connecting those new students with folks that are currently on the land. I think it's a lot of value. It's set up. We're ready. And beginning to use it is only the next step.
Another question that comes to mind from one of the things that you mentioned, Seth, is that, you know, it's a special thing to come back to a rural area.
Absolutely.
And I wonder whether or not you felt your communities were as welcoming for a new generation coming in, because it's different for a lot of these small towns. They might not have the things you're used to in colleges, might not have the infrastructure, might not have the social life that you had become accustomed to when you were in a larger area. What about the rural areas and their embracing of young farmers? Has it been a very good experience for you, or have there been some challenges involved with your coming back to the farm?
Well, I'll say from my own personal experience, it's been kind of a mixed bag. It comes from two different fronts. I'm from a very rural area, but we're not a particularly strong agricultural area. 50 years ago, probably so, a lot of small farmers. But just because the top land we have, one program many of you are probably familiar with, CRP, when that came in, a lot of people found that their best land usage was to plant pine trees where they once had small plots of crops or raised cattle on. And so as that happened, we lost a lot of the agricultural sense of community that we had. So I'm in my county, to my knowledge, I'm probably the only full-time farmer between the age of 25 and 50. So from a standpoint of that, it can be a little bit lonely on a social front. I often say, you know, I love going to farming conferences because that's the only time I get to see people who do what I do for a living. But even that said, even though there's not many people like me in my community, I feel like our community is very supportive of our farm and what we do. And the feedback I get from people in the community is that they feel good knowing there's still somebody there locally producing food. And even though the milk from our farm, we don't market it off of our farm. We don't have our own brand, and you can't point to a shelf in the local grocery store and say that came from Gilmer Dairy Farm. But just knowing we're there seems to be comforting to people. And one way I can gauge that by is the way our farm is laid out. And, you know, we don't have a whole lot of traffic on County Road 36 in Lamar County, but we use the two lanes sometimes as a cattle way, moving cows from pasture to pasture. And sometimes you can kind of gauge what the community thinks about you by if they happen along when we have what we call a Lamar County cattle drive right down the middle of the road. You know, are people stopping and taking pictures with their phone and waving at us? Or are they sitting there behind the steering wheel just kind of glaring at us like you're slowing me down? And we overwhelmingly get more waves and honks and thumbs up and pictures mm-hmm. taken. So that's a good feeling and really helps us feel like, yeah, we have the only dairy in our county. There's only a handful of other farming operations. But though we are few in number, our community still supports us and is glad we're a part of it.
Other comments on that, Lee?
You know, when I left the small town of Roberta, we are basically in the middle of nowhere, but we're also, I tell people, we're 30 minutes away from everywhere. So we have larger cities that are close to us, driving distance, and we've always enjoyed that. We've always been thankful for our own seclusion, but plus also able to tap into certain amenities. When I went to school, all I wanted to do was get back home. I missed small town, love the small town. And one thing I would say about amenities, I graduated from Valdosta State in 2005. And in a fast-paced or technology-driven world, if you look over the past decade and a half, by the time I left school to the past 10 years getting back home, we now in my small town, we've got more amenities as far as internet, you know, capabilities. You have wire, you know,
iPhones now that just basically they put technology and information at your fingertips. So by the time of that decade leaving school to coming back home, you know, technology was there, and that's neat. I think that's been great, the way that technology has moved into the rural areas, and it's been very nice. But, you know, I never really missed those amenities. As far as our hometown, they've always been embracive of agriculture. We're not really, we'll be more like you will, not necessarily an ag-driven as far as our mindset. We don't really think of ourselves as an old farm town. But I think our farmers are very well respected in our area. We have some good farmers in our area that that actually, I think, do a good job of creating the right image or showing the right image, not necessarily creating. But people have a great respect in our area for our farmers, and it's neat to be a part of that. And a lot of understanding. You know, sometimes we might cause a traffic jam in town, but they're okay. And they don't get too bent out of shape about it. But very embracing, very respected, I think, in our town, and very approving and appreciated. People love the idea, same as you will. I know who our birds go to, but, you know, I could not pinpoint it to one chicken sandwich. But people that I know and that know me and that have been to our farm, they love the thought that when they go and eat at certain restaurants, that they say, hey, I may have eaten one of your chickens today. And they love it. They do. They appreciate that. And I appreciate that, you know, their thoughts on that. So they do. They think we're all interesting in a good way.
I think there's maybe two different sentiment fronts. The folks in town, to my experience, have all been very welcoming. They like to see folks making a living off their local land. I mean, they want to see that. They don't want to see land and old names go the way of the dinosaur, you might say it that way. Now, of course, margins are slim and the risks are high, and so I'm doing a bit of assumption here, but I would imagine that the landowners around home would have rather, maybe to some extent, rather I didn't come back, because that would have been more land for them to be able to cover more risk, to compete in shorter margins markets. And in another way, old grudges die hard. So my great-great-grandfather, the guy that homesteaded, and this is crazy, he had a herd of cows, he had a little herd of sheep. He kept the herd of sheep in the valley all year, and they went to the north border of the property and got into the neighbor's ground. That was, no kidding, something like 1915. And our neighbor's great-grandson spoke to me when I was about 10, and my grandfather's comment was, wait, he spoke to you? Now, that's incredible. And I think there is some of that will still remain. So I'm sure there's that feeling, but it's small. It's not one you'd notice day to day.
I actually don't find that amazing at all. But it's a good one, Joel.
I guess as I got engaged back in my local community and you know, became active, I guess I can't sit still, and I'm always looking for that next opportunity. So I got involved in some of the ag organizations of the farm bureaus and the corn and soybean growers and our sheep association, etc. As soon as I go to a meeting, I'm next appointed as an officer of that club. And so the human capital in these communities is starving and looking for leaders. And I Absolutely. Found that to be a great opportunity, especially when I was in a business where I was selling products. As a lender, I got to meet all the area farmers because they were latching on to me, and I was engaged in their community. And now as a producer full-time, I'm still involved in those organizations, and we're doing some exciting things to share our story, and the wiser folks in those committees and those rooms are now re-energized. And that's really fun and exciting to see people who have sat on a county board for 20 and 30 years and say, we've done that, we've tried this, we're done. And then when you can bring some new energy and new enthusiasm, they get excited as well to share their story. And so when I can get some of those farmers in front of kids and share their story, it just becomes full circle. So it's been extremely supportive. But if anything, it becomes taxing on us because you do one thing and you might get 12. But busy people get things done, and I love that challenge of being able to do that.
So you mentioned sharing your story, and I think almost everyone here has a Twitter account. I know that you've all been active in even bringing people out to your farm. It's evidenced by your movie role. But Tell us a little bit about how, on a day-to-day basis, you think about getting out more information about agriculture and modern farming. Do you get up every day and say, I'm going to tweet a photo of my cows or sing another song?
I tweet pretty prolifically.
And the genesis of me wanting to share my farm story really did start in college. As I mentioned earlier, I went to Mississippi State University, which has a strong ag program, but I noticed that with the exception of those of us within the College of Agriculture, most of my fellow students didn't really grasp what was happening in modern agriculture. So as I came back home, I wanted to do something to be able to share my story, because my thought at the time was, just looking around, how many farmers are left, you know, producing across the country, and so many of the policy things that we would be facing, you know, both then and in the future, like realizing that we were going to have a diminished capacity to influence that policy if there were fewer and fewer of us. So how do you get people on your side? You tell them your story, and hopefully you can win them over to actually helping you accomplish some of your policy goals. So at this time, social media still wasn't in the picture, but we started a farm website, which I used essentially to put pictures of our farm and some basic information about who we are. And I try to use it as a gateway to tell people, this is our story. And other farmers, you know, whether it be dairy or somebody growing crops, we all are unique in the details, but these are some of the overall goals that we're trying to accomplish, you know, being good stewards of our land, good stewards of our animals, and producing the safest, most abundant crop we possibly can. From that, I started using social media a few years ago as that became more popular. I started blogging occasionally. Then as Twitter and Facebook became more popular, I started a Twitter account, which I do a lot of times. If you look at Twitter or my account somewhere around 5 o'clock in the morning, you'll have a pretty good idea how many cows I've milked by that time. I share a lot when nobody else is awake. Maybe not the smartest use of my time or best time management, but also have a Facebook page for my farm now. And you had mentioned earlier videos. I have a little over 100 videos on YouTube, and I wanted to do that originally. When I finally got a smartphone, because at the time we still had 28.8 dial-up at home. DSL had not made it to our area, but my smartphone had the capability of taking video, and then I could upload a video directly to YouTube from that. And so, you know, nothing quite shows what a farming operation or anything is like video, because you have the component of visual and audio aspect of it. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, how am I going to get, you know, I'm this one small dairy farmer in nowhere, Alabama. How am I going to get the world to pay attention to anything I do or any interest? So I really jumped off, I had to make the decision, if I'm going to do it, I'm just going to have to go all out on this to start with. So I made some really incredibly silly and stupid videos to start with, just acting, you know, almost, you know, I don't want to say acting like an idiot, but some stuff where I really let my guard down. I was really silly, but everything, the idea was to still get the message out there, what I was trying to get across, get it, put it out there in a way that somebody would be entertained by it, but still catch on to what I was trying to get at. And I had a lot of success with that initially, got a following, and from there I kind of toned it down and was a little more just straight-out information. And I'm glad to see that there are other people on farms across the country that have kind of taken up the mantle of the more entertainment side of it, getting their messages across. But I found it's been a really good way for me to connect with people throughout the country, people who live in places that they otherwise would never have heard of my dairy farm, or may not have ever had the opportunity to visit, see, or talk to a dairy farmer, period. And so that's been a real successful tool for me in helping share my story and helping people understand what happens on a day-to-day basis on my farm and other farms across the country.
You think maybe you were like an early help to the Peterson brothers to get their career?
I don't know. I've never heard them credit me, but, you know, I'll keep my fingers crossed. If so, maybe they'll send me a royalty check someday.
There you go. Well, I think Water and Poo is my favorite. I'd highly recommend it. But your Twitter hashtag, if people want to follow you?
Gilmer Dairy.
Okay. Seth, social media.
I come from the social media generation. College campus runs on it. Student youth organizations, whether that's Student Idle Cattlemen's or Collegiate Farm Bureau, the Sustainability Center, it's all social media based. Communicating via Facebook, posting Vine videos, and yada yada, the list goes on. I've kind of decided that different social media platforms I use for different purposes. If I can at any time share video or pictures, I think that's more effective. People want something quick. And my audience being college students, informational content doesn't resonate as well. If I type a very long Facebook or tweet post, it's not going to get read. So I try to keep it pretty short, maybe link to an article. But it's directing people. It's putting it in front of them. It doesn't have to be perfect, and it doesn't have to be exhaustive, and you don't have to be an expert. It's just about getting enough information out there that we begin to have a presence on the internet. We all know the things that come up when you search for information in the internet. There's as much contrary as there is positive, and I'd like to see that ratio tilt a little more in the favor of the people who are actually on the ground. I think that that's beneficial for the whole industry. If you're going to ask, the Twitter handle is Seth B. Pratt.
Thank you. You read my mind. Joel?
I'm learning on the social media. That's evolved as I've evolved a little bit. I personally love the personal experience, and I like to invite folks out as much as possible to come join us. You know, the challenge is farming is very weather dependent. Even doing daily chores can be very decisive and hard to plan. So as I'm inviting people, you know, I'll put out 50 to 100 invitations to come join me in the combine during fall and check that out, or come plant our crops this spring, or come and grab some green peas when they're fresh, while they're eatable for about 6 days. And if you're not there, they become too hard and tardy, and you don't want to eat them. So, you know, so utilizing new media is a great way for us to share that story, but getting people on the ground and hands-on experience is still my favorite, and we'll continue to make that offering.
Terrific. Kate, how about you?
I'm a bit of an old soul. I don't have a tattoo. I don't have any piercings, clip-on earrings. And I am of the social media era, but I guess I don't resonate with that. I would much rather talk to you. I would much rather know your story so you can know mine. I would rather resonate with you. And so when I'm out on my farm, I don't think that I'm doing is anything out of the norm. I was actually, one thing I was really excited the other day that somebody said I should have posted was I got a new air chuck to air up my dual tires on my semi, and I thought it was so exciting because I could just straight air it up and it didn't have this angle and fight it, and I feel like I have to reach my little hands in there, and I you know, my acrobatic skills are very underappreciated on my farm from my father of how I do some things. So I would much rather talk to somebody, but I think that I need to become better about what I'm doing, and I need to share that message. And I, you know, I need to say that GMOs are good and pesticides, you know, are used, you know, well, so I'm going to try to be better about that. I'm going to work on that.
And are you on Twitter as well?
I am. I am on Twitter. I made it before I got married, and so it's Kate Longley 2.
And I forgot to get yours.
Joel Mathwitz, all one word.
All right. How about you, Lee?
I am a lazy Facebook poster and tweeter. But I do love absorbing information off of the two. I take advantage of them, but I don't contribute back, and that's something that I have tried to work on. I knew Will back before he had a smartphone, I think, and if anybody in this world has earned a smartphone, it was Will. He was doing the things on social media when he had I remember him saying he had dial-up, and he'd have to upload these things, and it's, you know, I don't know. Probably take him a half a day or something to do it.
The advantage was I didn't have to field phone calls once I got home because I had the modem tied up.
But very, very dedicated to that and has done an outstanding job of sharing our story. I love to share our story. I dislike any untruths in a lot of it, in any area. You know, I don't like misconceptions. I don't like speculation on, well, I think something's like this, therefore that's how it is in my mind and in my life. I like to know how things are. And so especially with something as personal as agriculture and as our industry, any opportunity to share those truths and to clarify some of those misconceptions that just get basically ran wild with. I'm in full support of it. Social media has created an incredible avenue to do that. You know, I mean, the videos, the posts, the pictures, there's so much that it has just bridged so many gaps for people. And I think started a whole lot of conversation for what we do. And it's been great. I still love, with Joel, I love people, to be able to communicate with people one-on-one. We love the opportunity for people to come to our farm. And that's something we're kind of new to. You know, you really didn't grow up with people beating down the door to come to your farm. In the past decade, I think there has been a huge interest sparked in agriculture and where people's food comes from, the food that they eat. And we've recognized a huge importance of giving them that answer, because people will come up with an answer. Whether it's right or wrong, they'll come up with an answer. And so we love the opportunity on our farm to share, to show them, to tell them whatever, you know, they want to do. We offer opportunities for kids to come out. We have one kindergarten class, or one teacher that we work with in particular. Every spring she brings her kids out. We go and visit their class. We do a lot through our local farm bureaus, state farm bureaus, of ways to just share our story, share what we do. And, you know, if somebody's wondering how something is, I love the opportunity to give them firsthand experience and let them see it. But, you know, social media has just created opportunities for people to see a farm, meet a farmer. You know, if you want to meet Will Gilmer, out of those 100 videos, you can get him summed up pretty good. He's a hoot. A lot of fun.
Mr. Cooley, to bridge a little bit from that comment, you talk about this opportunity to share information. We've all been following MH370 and the flight that infamously disappeared. And I remember just a few days after it hit the news feeds, posts on Facebook that they'd found it, that it was in the, that it was here, it was there, and acted as if something had happened. They fabricated this ending. And while we all pray for an ending that brings those folks back, it was blatantly dishonest to put that information out there. And how can we have the same critical eye we have for that type of information also for agriculture information? Because there are things we see on the internet, the equal level of dishonesty that we see with how folks have handled that flight information.
Sure.
So that's something we need to promote and spread. Be critical about the information you see, and do dig for that truth that you mentioned, Mr. Cooley. I think that's important.
You don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but not everything you read on the internet is true, but some people some people hang their hats on it. And so it's been great opportunities for us. And but that is, you know, social media, we do have to be careful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you're bringing up a good question. How do you deal with that opposition? I mean, you can get out there and you can try to address it on the internet, but let's face it, there's going to be people that don't like the use of antibiotics, that don't like the use of biotechnology. There's a lot of different topics out there that are really coming at American agriculture, and people need to have answers to those. So are you each trying to address them in individual ways?
I even though we grow all GMOs on our farm, I am full support of organic, and I just think that it rings red, white, and blue of our country that we have a choice, that we have an opportunity for what we eat, and we know how it's produced. So I'm full support as long as it's safely grown, it's ethically grown. I'm in full support of all kinds of agriculture.
Terrific. I see we have a questioner at the microphone.
Since we have a movie star, I was wondering if you could talk about his experience in this making of farmland.
I wish Brad could join me. Brad's the movie star of the room. That's why they had to keep him hidden back there. But, it was an incredible experience. You know, when I was first contacted by Allentown, your first response is, you know, give me all your information so that I can find out a little bit more about you, and that's what I did, and I was so intrigued and interested in the opportunity to share our story, and I had no idea the magnitude of farmland at the time, you know, even in the beginning stages, but when you get a call to share, basically that's what we've all talked about. We do, we recognize the importance of sharing our story, of sharing our farm, and like Will said, video, when you can put sound and audio and really capture something in that way, it just brings a whole other dynamic to the table. And so to have the opportunity to maybe be involved in that, because I didn't know when I got the first call, it was just maybe a chance, would you be interested is what they asked. And I immediately said, I think I will, let me get back with you. And so as things progressed, and you kind of start getting a little bit of credibility, you find out, kind of where it's going, what their angles, and the hope of it. And when I found out, truly realized for the first time that it was what farmland was, what the project was, to try to capture American agriculture. Six young farmers who were, next generation on their farm. And basically when I figured that out, it was an incredible, opportunity to move in that direction. It was something that with my family, we are, one thing that, with all of us, I think that we would definitely say is probably as young faces and kind of with the social media and kind of where we are generationally, we're the ones who get to be in the forefront and in the picture of our farms. We're the one who kind of becomes the face of our farm. And the coolest thing about it, though, is that behind each one of us, there is a family farm. That doesn't mean that there's a piece of land that we left behind. There's a farm that's going on right now. There's birds in our houses back at home that somebody's looking after. And, it's our family that runs and operates. And so they have the opportunity basically to showcase that in a sense of saying, this is what we do. For everything that you've been worried about, and what it is that you're concerned about with your food, this is how it's grown, and we are the ones who grow it. Anytime you have a... It's not every day that you hear or that a Hollywood production company calls and asks to come shoot some footage on your farm. So that's kind of uncharted territory, I would say. And so the anxiety of not anxiety, but just the anxiousness of wondering what it's going to be like. When are they going to come? What are they going to be like? How's it going to go? It's exciting. And when they show up, it was really neat. And the director, James Mole, and his crew could not have been any more. They couldn't have been any more accommodating for us. And, I've spoken with three other of the film subjects, and we all felt the same way. They couldn't have been any more accommodating. And their focus, their vision at the beginning of it was to capture the American farm, to capture it in its purest. And there was a lot of trust with the film of, basically giving them the chance to actually see what we do, and trust that what they put together would be a positive response for agriculture. And because we all know that, the same picture can be painted with two different stories. And I was very, very, very pleased with the way farmland has turned out. Cannot wait for you guys to get to see it tomorrow night or whenever you will have the opportunity to see it. But it was a great experience. Great experience. So honored to be a part of it, to be asked to be a part of it.
So thank you. Peter, you've been soaking this all in. I know a little earlier you were taking notes on some of the things that you were learning from our distinguished other panelists here. Tell us what you are thinking in terms of the future of agriculture in light of the experience that you're hearing today and the opportunities that are out there. What have you been gleaning from some of these comments?
Well, for the Smithsonian, the challenge is really providing that stage that I think that we were discussing about, that we have a fair amount of credibility. We have 5 million visitors that come to the building every year, millions more that come via the internet. So for us, we provide sort of a proven stage for a conversation that can be a little bit more neutral, that we're balanced and fair. One of the things that we're really striving to do is show the complexity of what agriculture is about, that it has continued to change. There are a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different challenges. And then to make it present day, make it contemporary. Our visitors really want to see what's going on. And in our demonstration stage area, we're actually developing public programs that will allow visitors that come to D.C., see the exhibition, to be able to via the web go out and talk to farmers, see what's going on, and get a sense of it. So that background of what has happened and really then connect it to the contemporary action of today.
Thank you. The questions are still coming in on Twitter and Facebook, and Claire wants to know, Kate, what your biggest challenge is since you've returned to the farm as a female farmer, and then some other questions here have to deal with, really, how do we bring more women into agriculture in general? So your comments.
Okay. I get asked this women question a lot, and I'm going to be 100% honest. I don't know how to answer them because I don't know any different. You know, I came back and I worked well with my dad. It didn't really matter what gender I was. I worked well with dad, and I enjoy learning. The biggest challenge that I've had was this last fall, and how dad and I usually get the crop out of the field is I run the semi, he runs the combine, and we flip off on the auger wagon. Okay. And my dad's knees, I mean, he's 63, and he needed his knee replaced. And so normally we climb in and out of our machinery about 10 to 12 times a day. And I was concerned that he wasn't even going to get in there once. Or if he was, he was going to hoist and he was going to work on his upper arm strength. And so we needed somebody else to come in. And I asked my husband. He started his own excavation business. And he was kind of looking to, he had a seed salesman job, but his boss wanted him to sell chemicals and fertilizer and seed and run his excavation business. And he's like, something really has to give because I'm taking away time from you. And I said, well, how about you take your excavation full time, and I need you this fall. Can you come work this fall? And he's from a farm. He grew up on a farm, a small farm in Virginia, so he's got a livestock background and a crop background. So he was a great fit. But the hardest part was not him coming, because he's such a viable source. He's you know, my encouragement every day. It was my own insecurities, because I take so much pride in my job, and that really is a title of who I am. I'm Kate Danner. I'm a farmer, and you know, to be the fifth Longley to take over the farm, and then all of a sudden I'm a Danner. It's, well, who the heck is who's Kate Danner? I just think that it was a challenge to you know, not just for marriage, but it was you know, I was sharing my name, and now I was sharing my career. But I really realized that it was my own insecurities, and it was my own jealousy that wasn't allowing me to, for him to complete us instead of us to compete for the same job. So that has been the most challenging, and we enjoy working together, just maybe not seven consecutive days. Yeah.
So. Oh, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Other thoughts on bringing more diversity into agriculture? I know that when you go to the FFA convention like we did this last fall, it's just booming with so many students, and a lot of them are from urban areas or inner cities. And so that seems like that is a nice pathway for introduction. But other ideas on how we can bring another generation in that is more diverse and attracting those folks that may not, again, have had the farm background into agriculture? Thoughts from...
Take a swing at it. Diversity is a touchy topic, because when you say the word diversity, you're kind of claiming to be able to touch on everything. And human nature and my own fallibility will mean I can't touch on everything. But there is as I look across our classrooms, I see more young agriculture students deciding to study foreign languages. I think that's valuable both on a trade front as we engage in trade with other countries, and then also perhaps English as a second language folks don't make up the majority of ownership, but let's look at the majority of contribution to food production. And the producers realize that. And I think when you look at what would it take to start my own restaurant or start my own mechanic shop, well, first things first, get a job at one of those places, slowly work my way up. And small farms may not have that vertical structure, but larger farms do. And some of the best producers that I know, be they dairy or in orchards, are not white Caucasian males like myself. Now, they may be female, like Miss Kate. They may be from another country, and they moved to the United States. And I don't think there are... I'm going to take a risk and say I don't think that there are structural barriers to that, though I would admit there are social barriers. And those are harder because they're more gray. They're more fuzzy, and you don't know where the line is. You know, it's hard to fix something that doesn't have parts. But if we can change social beliefs and continue to work on acceptance in rural communities, which I think is happening perhaps more than the folks that live within the Beltway realize, I think it is happening. Is this something that maybe the other panelists, you know better in your home communities? I can say that for Idaho, but that's just one.
Other thoughts on that?
Well, I was just going to echo that. I mean, I think agriculture is diverse. And when you think about the global need for food production, we're a very diverse group of farmers. Our panel maybe doesn't depict that today, you know, but if you get to travel globally or different regions, even in this country, and a lot of the localized farming is of different ethnic backgrounds. And so I think there is a big diverse, and that's important as we move forward. And we're going to need all hands on deck to produce the food that we're going to need in this global economy that we now live in today. And so I just think that it is there, and we just need to encourage it. And as Seth was saying, as we got some barriers that we're just going to have to continue to challenge ourselves to knock down and move forward.
Sure. One of the things, Seth, you just kind of, maybe look at something a little bit different perspective. But I think FFA does a great job of just getting young kids interested in agriculture. They really do. I mean, I think about in our hometown. We have a great FFA program at our this high school, middle school that I graduated from. And they do a great job of getting them interested. The tough part is when if they go through all the right channels, they get out of college, the thought is, I'm going to be a farmer. I'm going to become a farmer. And in their mind, that is, I'm going to own my own farm. And I think that might be where a little bit of the thought is, just like you said, a mechanic, you know, you don't get out of school the first day and normally, typically, you don't own, just, you know, get financing to go buy your own mechanic shop and become boss. You start working at one. And I think the biggest thing might be, you know, patience. Help them see patience, that you don't start off typically as an owner from day one. They're, you know, most multi-generational farms, you don't even start off as an owner day one. There are some unique situations. Me personally, I had that unique situation that I started off as an owner immediately on my own farm before we were, you know, before Dad and I really partnered up. But the thing also is, I started at the bottom, not when I came out of college, but I started at the bottom when I was about 8 years old. You know, we grew up working on the farm. We grew up doing the jobs that nobody, when I say we, I have a sister that's 3 years older and one that's a year younger. My baby sister, we used to have a harder time getting her to work, but still, you know, she had to be there. She might wasn't as productive as me and my older sister were at certain times, but we grew up starting at the bottom, working. You know, and my dad's always said, you talk about bringing kids back to the farm, he's told me when I first, or really before I had kids, and now especially that I have two boys, you know, with your kids especially, you can't wait till they're grown up to get them to start doing stuff with you, because then they won't really want to. They have other things. And I take my two boys now that are 2 and 3 years old, they're nothing that they want to do more than get in the truck and go with me wherever I'm going, you know, and to work. And that's, when we go to the farm, that's, they love it. That's what they love doing. But we started on the bottom. Me personally, you know, I started on the bottom when I was 8. I worked all the way through elementary school, middle school, high school, college. You know, I was able to play sports. Daddy always did a great job of helping us to appreciate the farm and not, you know, there were times that my friends went and did things that I had, you know, we still had hay in the field. And I, you know, it's like, oh, I wish I were doing anything but this now because my friends are having fun. But it also created that ground level work, you know, where we kind of paid our dues early and were able to come out. But long, you know, narrowing that down, these kids that are coming out of high school and college, I think getting a job on a farm, you know, helping them see, you got to start at the bottom. You do have a college degree, but you do still have to start somewhere. And if you really want to be a farmer, then it takes patience. It takes us a lot longer to retire. you know, we don't necessarily have a 30-year plan there, but
absolutely.
But you know, I think that patience.
I think one of the things that's pretty important to recognize that agriculture has always been diverse. That the nature of diversity has just changed. That if you look back 4 or 5 generations, the chances of one of your ancestors having come from a different country is probably pretty substantial. That in 1910, there are a lot of communities, people were speaking German or Polish or Czechoslovakian. That was to a great degree Europeans, but from a lot of different folks. And that agriculture at that time was something that everybody understood, and it was something much sought after. But one of the things that's really critical is doing what's being done here today is providing role models. That people make decisions on what to do based on great role models. And they really need to, putting a face on agriculture so that you not only have a sense of where food comes from, but who's making that, who's for you, and how exciting it is. That the notion that agriculture is a sophisticated operation. You have to be darn smart to be successful. So movies like Farmland, television shows maybe that have agriculture in it, museum exhibitions, all of these things raise it up and really start to create that situation where people want to go into agriculture.
So I think we've got time for about one more question, and since we're in the nation's capital, I mean, an obvious one we haven't asked yet is what types of federal policies, if any, would you like to see out there to enhance the ability of people to get into farming and ranching? And I know, Joel, that you had mentioned that you've used a USDA Beginning Farmer and Ranching Program. There's a lot more incentives in this new Agricultural Act of 2014, our Farm Bill. Microloans that are going to be out there for individuals that want to borrow up to $50,000. Any other ideas on what you'd like to see for federal policies to help people get started in agriculture?
Well, I'll definitely take a stab at this. I've had some international experience, and one of the things that has really caught home to me is the importance of sound policy, because it really does set the rules of the game and give us either opportunities or hurdles that we have to accomplish. And as I'm back on the family farm now and have the older generation that would like to transition out, we're trying to figure out how to transfer those assets so we don't have to repurchase them. Well, so what is our tax code and what is our ability to transfer those to allow a business to continue without us treading our wheels, spinning our wheels in that aspect? So having sound policy all the way through is critical, and having a long-range vision. I had the opportunity to be in China this spring. You know, they're going to feed 1.3 billion people, and they have a 100-year plan on how they're going to accomplish that. Obviously, one of them, I hope, is they'll continue to buy our American product that we can ship to them. But what is our 100-year plan? You know, heck, my biggest challenge is getting internet connection so I can talk to the rest of the world. Well, that's an important issue in rural communities that we need to accomplish, but then what's the next vision of that? So having policy that expires and we go 18 months or 3 years without knowing the rules of the game is unfair to any business. And so just having a long-term plan, I think, is critical, and I'm glad we have a five-year plan so we can make some five-year goals. But I think we're all here to say we want to be in this industry and represent these businesses for the next 40 years and provide it for the next generation. So long-term and some stability from that standpoint would be my wish list.
Thank you. Other thoughts on?
To kind of, in addition to that, one thing I think is to have a accurate and a realistic understanding of how many people, however many years from now, 25, 50, even to your 100-year plan, how many Americans, how many people that American farmers on American soil will have to feed down the road? A realistic number and thought. And basically create channels of how we're going to do that.
And then a game plan is...
It's not going to go down. Yeah, it's not going to decrease.
Kate, how about you? What kind of federal policy?
I would really just like to see consistency all across the board. You know, good, bad, I would just like to see consistency. I know that when Obama took office in like 2008, you know, all I heard was biorenewables and renewable energy. And then the EPA came out, you know, this last year and they cut by 45%. You know, they don't want to use biorenewables anymore, and it's, you know, well, what messages is the government really trying to send to us? And I guess that's the most frustrating part, you know, on the bottom end of, you know, what do you really want to see? What do you really want from us? You know, we are making the changes, and we can make those changes, but we need you to let us know what you want. So I want to see consistency across the board. I know that we'll never get it, but I just... Yeah.
An optimist and a realist at the same time. I love it. Other ideas?
And I, you know, kind of along the same vein, I think most important, it may not necessarily be the tools to help us start out, but the policy that helps us to continue our business. You know, and mentioned about the consistency, you know, there's so many different, whether it's something that comes through the legislative process or something through the regulatory process, so many different individual aspects of policy touch our businesses. And it can make it difficult because as soon as you plan or you have an expectation, you know, as mentioned, what the rules of the game are, before you know it, those might be changing in one area. And before you can do whatever you need to do on your farm or ranch to either come into compliance or position yourself for the future in that area. Lo and behold, here's from another area. Here comes another something that you're having to turn your attention to. And as young farmers and ranchers, especially those who are starting out, who might be carrying a higher debt load from the credit they've had to finance their farm and ranch, well, before you can get that paid off, you're now already having to turn around and invest thousands and thousands, perhaps millions more, just to keep up to date with what the new rules of the game are. And we're always going to have that. That's a challenge we'll always face. And I think our generation really realizes this, that it really is incumbent on us to be a participant in the policy process, to talk to our elected officials, to talk with people within the regulatory process, and let them know how decisions that are made in Washington, D.C., in our state capitals, or even at our own county levels affect our livelihoods on our farm. And we have to show, first of all, with whatever we have, we have to be good stewards of that. And I think if we can show people the steps we're already taking to make sure that our businesses are sustainable, that our land is viable for agricultural production for the next however many generations of our family or whoever might be to take it over, that, you know, if we can share that story, I think that will help us in that aspect. And sometimes it may seem like we're just trying to fill up the ocean one rock at a time. But every time we throw a rock in, it may not be much, but the ocean's just a little bit more shallow. And if we all continue to do that, I think that's that will be helpful in the future.
Seth, any final thoughts on that?
I've spent some time in Washington, D.C., and I don't necessarily prescribe to the sentiment back home when people really just attack the city and say, there's nothing great comes out of that town. I mean, I know when you come across the Beltway, you gain some expertise that, gosh, I wish was more present in rural America. I admire the level of drive for information that this city has. But when I go home and work with my dad and my grandpa, I realize that when you cross the Beltway, you also lose a level of on-the-ground practicality. And what it takes to make something pass this city is different than what really makes a difference on the ground. That's a challenge. I think we need to be intimately familiar with that challenge and figure out how we create programs and policies that address that. It's not just about what do we have to do to get this to pass. It's what do we have to do to get this to make a difference and really count for the people of this country. Do we need lots of Band-Aids and tools and assistance? A little cold, hard entrepreneurial spirit, I'd say no. I see the people in our in classes at school, whether they come from farms or they don't, that have the work ethic and the ambition to make this happen. My great-grandfather said, you don't have to want to work hard, but you'd better.
Smart man.
So that's what I'll leave it. That may be a little hard line. I think that there's intelligent things that can be done, proactive things that help us secure financing, that help us meet farmers that would like to find someone to pass their estate to, that don't have folks coming back, and that there's not an established forum for people to do that. I'd like to see that happen.
All right, thank you. Last word, Peter.
Just wanted to throw one point in here that we may have overlooked, and to rephrase the question a little bit, what should government be doing rather than just what should Washington be doing? Because, of course, government is all throughout the country. And one of the things that really is defining for the United States and really separates it from agriculture in many other countries is the land-grant college system. And as everybody spoke today, they talked about their college experience. Farmers in the United States are smart. These are educated folks. This is efficiency. This is really doing the right thing. And the land-grant colleges really set a tone in terms of research and giving the farmers of America access, and I think that's just continues to be a governmental role that's really important, is to make sure that we have the most sophisticated farmers and ranchers that we could possibly have for the future.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Well, we've run out of time, and I would like to just thank one more time our excellent panelists here today for all your contributions. And thanks to all of you for your participation. On behalf of AgriPulse and the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, I'd like to really thank all of you for not only your interest today, but what we hope will be your interest in the farmland documentary and the private showing tomorrow evening. If you've not signed up yet and gotten your movie pass, you can go to fooddialogues.com and make sure that you can get signed up for that important showing of the documentary. I think you're really going to enjoy it. So with that, thanks again, and I hope you all enjoy the rest of your Ag Day. I know I've got a couple more events to go to yet, and hopefully we'll see you all a little bit later. So thanks very much.